7BR Part Heard.
Hello and welcome to 7BR's 12 Days of Christmas. I'm Eleanor Day, Chambers paralegal, and here on the Part Heard podcast, we've spent the last 6 months traversing the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. Now, as we near the end of this most unusual of years, we're taking the opportunity for reflection. So each day for the next 12 days, a different member will discuss a 2020 case of theirs in a sort of legal advent calendar. Today, Leslie Keegan is here to speak about the case of Constance against the Ministry of Defence and Portsmouth Hospital NHS Trust. Leslie is a specialist in clinical negligence and personal injury cases. Before coming to the bar, he was a neurophysiologist, and his medical expertise makes him particularly suitable to act for claimants in cases involving serious brain injury or complex medical issues. Having been called to the Irish Bar, Leslie has also contributed to legal journals and to television and radio programmes on both sides of the Irish Sea, as well as running a very busy practice dealing with all aspects of clinical negligence and personal injury law.
I'm going to talk to you today about the case of Warren Constance against the Ministry of Defence and Portsmouth Hospitals University NHS Trust. It's an interesting case for many reasons. I will only touch on a few of these here today and therefore recommend a read of the detailed judgment of Mr. David Locke QC, who is sitting as a Deputy High Court Judge in this case in October 2020. The claimant, Mr. Constance, had been a serving soldier. He was a senior NCO in the Royal Artillery. He was a specialist in that he operated a ground command station for UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, more commonly referred to as drones. He suffered from a hearing loss, which due to its misdiagnosis led to him being discharged from the army on medical grounds. What he didn't know until after he was discharged was that there was a simple operation called a stapedectomy, which could have dealt with his hearing loss, and that he could have then continued in his army career. As I said, there are two defendants. One was his employer, the Ministry of Defence, and the second was Portsmouth Hospitals University Trust, both of whom gave the claimant specialist ENT treatment. The judgment gives a nice, concise explanation of two major types of deafness. The first is the sensorineural hearing loss, which can be caused by excessive noise, so sometimes referred to as noise-induced hearing loss. And it means there's a problem in the inner ear or in the auditory nerve that delivers sound to the brain. This type of hearing loss is a permanent hearing loss that occurs when there's damage to either the tiny hair-like cells of the inner ear or the auditory nerve itself, and prevents or weakens the transfer of nerve signals to the brain. In the case of this type of noise-induced hearing loss, it's important to protect the patient or the soldier from further exposure to loud noises. So if somebody's in the armed services, they need to be protected from exposure to gunfire in particular, and loud noises. The other major type of hearing loss is conductive hearing loss, and that happens when sounds cannot get through the outer and middle ear. The sound is not conducted to the inner ear, and generally it's due to a problem with the ear canal, the eardrum, or the three bones, the ossicles that transmit sound from the eardrum to the middle ear. The difference here with this type of hearing loss, the conductive hearing loss, is that it is treatable, and the particular type of hearing loss that the claimant had was treatable by way of surgery. As I said, a relatively simple surgical procedure. Although there are several erroneous references in the claimant's army medical records to him having a noise-induced hearing loss, he didn't have this condition and never had this condition. What he had was a conductive hearing loss. It's also significant that while noise-induced hearing loss is permanent and further noise exposure causes progression of this type of hearing loss. There is some evidence that conductive hearing loss can actually be protective for noise-induced damage, since the loud noises are not actually transmitted to the inner ear. The most important thing about the wrong classification of Mr. Constance's hearing loss is that it led to him being moved from his role as a drone operator or mission controller to working in the officer's mess, wearing a hearing aid, and ultimately led to his discharge on medical grounds. This case is also interesting because it has a very thorough explanation in the judgment of the medical grading of military personnel, which is set out in the Pulliam's administrative pamphlet. Although it's referred to as a pamphlet, as the judge correctly pointed out in the judgment, the pamphlet runs to a few hundred pages. The acronym Pulliam's, PULHHEEMS, takes its name from the first letters of the division under which each part of the medical examination is carried out. P being physical capacity, which is used to indicate an individual's overall physical development and his or her capacity for physical training and suitability for employment. U refers to upper limbs, and it indicates the functional use of the hands, arms, shoulders, cervical and thoracic spines. L is for locomotion, and it refers to the individual's ability to march or to run, and it involves an assessment of the lumbar spine, the pelvis, the hips, the legs, knees, ankles and feet. H assesses the auditory acuity only for the right and then the left ear. EE assesses visual acuity only for the right and then the left eye. M assesses mental capacity, that is the individual's ability to learn military skills and duties. And S refers to stability, that is emotional stability. As a result of the Pulliam's assessment, armed forces personnel are awarded what's called a P grade. P2, P3 and P7 are the ones which are important in this case. P2 means medically fit for unrestricted service worldwide. P3 means medically fit for duty with nothing more than minor employment limitations. And P7 means medically fit for duty, but with major employment limitations. There's a very interesting discussion in the judgment as to whether Mr. Constance, with surgery on his ear, would have been P2, that is medically fit for unrestricted service worldwide, as we argued, or P7, that is medically fit for duty, but with major employment limitations, which is what the defendants argued. But there's also an interesting argument that if he was P3, that is medically fit for duty with nothing more than minor employment limitations, then whether or not the fact that he would have been P3 would have to be specifically pleaded. We pleaded that with the surgery to his ear, he would have been P2, that is medically fit for unrestricted service worldwide. We did not plead the alternative P3. I say we, I didn't actually do the pleadings in this case. It was an old colleague who did. However, I was happy to maintain the argument that there was no prejudice caused to the defendants in any event. And we said that if he had been correctly diagnosed and correctly treated, he would have been P2 in any event. In this case, the defendants said it wasn't open to us to argue the P3 point because it wasn't pleaded. The judge looked at this and said, quote, applying the test from Donsala and Barr, the question is whether continuing in the army in a role such as a UAV trainer at a P3 or even a P7 medical grading is sufficiently different to continuing as a P2 soldier, whether on deployment or not, that it amounts to special circumstances and is of a sufficiently different kind that it should be the subject of a separate pleading. I do not accept that submission. End of quote. The case is also interesting because there's an examination regarding the system of medical board appeals and indeed who can institute these. Does it have to be the commanding officer, as was argued by the counsel for the first defendant, or as the Pulliam's pamphlet says, can it be instituted by the soldier himself or herself? The judge, unsurprisingly, pointed to the fact that the Pulliam's pamphlet actually says that it can be instituted by the soldier himself or herself. Finally, there's another interesting discussion in the case about the issue of what is written in the medical records. How many cases have claimant lawyers come across where there is important information which it is agreed should have been given to the patient? It's not recorded in the medical notes that it was actually given to the patient, but the treating doctor or surgeon says, well, it's not written there, but it was my normal practice to advise about this. And there's no reason why I would have departed from that practice. Well, it's worth looking at the Constance case in relation to this, because in this case, although the ENT surgeon for the trust, the second defendant, when he actually came to give evidence, accepted that it wasn't written in the notes that the claimant was advised about the possibility of an operation dealing with his hearing loss, he accepted that he should have been advised that an operation was possible. And he also accepted that it was a breach not to advise them. But the surgeon for the first defendant, the MOD, maintained it wasn't written there, but that it was his usual practice to do that, to say that the surgical procedure, the operation, was an option. And he wouldn't have departed from that. The claimant is wrong, it was said, when he said that he wasn't told about the option of an operation. And this surgeon also relied on the fact that he wrote at the clinical reviews that when the claimant was asked about his hearing, it was noted that he said, okay. But the claimant's argument about this was that he was asked about whether his hearing aid was working, and that's what he was saying okay about, and that he wasn't told that there was the option of the surgical procedure. It was agreed that Mr. Constant should have all the options discussed with him to enable him to make an informed choice. And having understood the risks and the benefits of the various treatment options available, the judge found that this had not been done, and he accepted Mr. Constant's evidence on the point. Anyway, It's all there in the Constance case, and it makes interesting reading for those dealing with MOD cases in general, and also for those who have one of those clinical negligence cases where the medical records say one thing and the doctor says, ah, yes, but although it's not written there, I always tell patients about it. And even if I didn't write it down, then there's no reason for me to have departed from it. Have a read. Interesting case. And thank you.
Thank you for listening to 7BR's 12 Days of Christmas. For more information and to listen to all our previous episodes, please visit our website.